Welcome to the Aesthetic City podcast. In this show, we aim to discover how to go forward and create a more livable, beautiful, and healthy built environment. I'm Ruben Hansen, your host and founder of the Aesthetic City. Today's guest is an Atlanta-based designer, urbanist, and master planner, celebrated for advancing new urbanism and designing whole new towns with a focus on the pedestrian experience. He masterfully blends local values, vernacular, and climate considerations into his work, ensuring that communities are not only livable, but also aesthetically enriching. His notable achievements include influential roles in projects like Trilith and Rosemary Beach, and numerous awards such as the Platinum and Gold Best in America Living Awards. Known for his attention to detail, form, and proportion, he creates designs that are both beautiful and innovative. So, without further ado, please welcome Lou Oliver. First of all, thank you so much for being here. It has been a great pleasure, of course, of meeting you in Utrecht at our summer school this year.
I very much enjoyed it. I had never been to Utrecht, if this is the way you say it. And it is it's a remarkable little city that really is so well preserved, considering the growth pressures that have been put on it. And it really enriched my view of how cities can be laid out. And it's particularly Dutch with this undercurrent of old industrial kind of on the river level and a really a civic oriented city on the next tier up. So there are two layers of urban activity that used to go on there that are remarkable that I think shaped the city. It really opened my eyes a lot.
Yeah. What parts of the city did you visit as an American, especially an American from Atlanta, a huge metropolitan area, of course? How did you experience that?
Well, for almost any American, especially one centered in Atlanta, which is very car-centric mostly, it's intensely moving to me to be able to walk around and actually see buildings that address the observer on a very intimate level. That is, every detail is at close range, and the whole city is essentially walkable anywhere in 10 minutes. And so for an American, it's a very rich experience, and one that you take back and you want to propagate in the best sort of way here. Mm-hmm. I really loved the complex mixing up of transportation systems, whether you're by train, bicycle, pedestrian, or car, all of these various modes of transportation mixed side by side in a very pleasurable and safe way. I'd always heard about the Vunerfs, and I got to experience them firsthand, and I think they're really magical and the ultimate in traffic calming. The Dutch towns have particularly small streets, and the face-to-face widths of facades that are framing streets are, they're very small. So it produces a neighborhood scale urbanism that is extremely pleasurable, as opposed to some of the grander streets or boulevard, more of what you would find in Central Europe and particularly in Paris. I think the intimacy in places like Utrecht and Amsterdam is exceptional.
Yeah, the Woonerfs, or the Woonerf, as we say in Dutch, are interesting because I think they're a concept from the 70s and 80s, and they really became world famous. I must say, like, they're often in those 80s neighborhoods, which aren't very aesthetically interesting.
Yes.
But they are very child friendly and very nice to grow up in.
Yeah, and even some of the old streets in Utrecht were, they were retrofitted with to have Wunnerf detailing. Mm-hmm. It seems that way to me. So it's a remarkable city. For me, the only tragic element in most of its 20th century, and particularly mid-20th century and later, on the fringes, just the mega-scaled kind of high-rise sprawl. And then the tragedy that befell the town center with the deconstructivist intervention, which destroyed the heart of Utrecht. And it would be wonderful to fantasize about that eventually being removed and put back like it was.
There's a lot of kind of wounds in the city heart, especially near the train station, where they destroyed an entire district just to build a huge, they thought they were building the future, but they built a future that would be demolished within 30, 40 years. And now they built the next future.
It's I think it's hard for contemporary culture to not think of themselves as really enlightened innovators. And so I think if the danger of that and going into a historic center like Utrecht is you destroy more than anything out of your own naivete, but you don't, but you don't consider yourself naive, of course. Consider yourself supremely enlightened, and that you're going to teach the old city a thing or two. So many ego and arrogance are not really good things.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that's one of the biggest problems nowadays with our, well, let's say the expert class. And that's also why we have this big, kind of a clash between the expert class and, let's say, the common population. And then we have the whole debate, disinformation, misinformation, because people are, challenging the expert class. Because with the internet, we have lounge chair experts rising up.
Yes.
We have, I mean, perhaps you could even count myself under that, because I'm kind of challenging the status quo as well, and using all these new techniques. But the point is that there is, I think, something which the expert class or the experts have overseen, and that is that their ideas sometimes really don't work, and they're invested in ideas that, that are basically bankrupt in some cases.
100%. And they have failed to understand basic social interaction and the idea that we can create forums for civic activity and celebrate the human habitation. And they've utterly failed to grasp what it takes to do that. They don't understand humans on a deep psychological level at all. Mm-hmm. And it's an abject failure. And agreed, we can only hope that some of these places will be demolished in the future, but they will not go out gracefully, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Before we move on, perhaps first a little bit of background about you, because you became an architect, you became a master planner, and you became successful in master planning. So where did that interest in cities and architecture and shaping our world come from? And how, how did that shape, and what happened during your path of becoming a designer and a master planner?
Sure. Well, I have my undergraduate degree in science, and I studied in the architecture school, but I'm actually not an architect. So I'm a designer. I have to call myself designer because it would be prohibited that I call myself an architect. And I don't have formal training in master planning whatsoever. It's all experience-based, but I've been fascinated by ancient cities my entire life, including sitting on a swing set in the backyard as a 2 or 3 year old and thinking about it. And I did not really play sports. I didn't do things other children did, but I would really wanted to see and experience these old cities, and I was fascinated by them, and particularly fascinated by architectural richness that the past held. So I grew up in an era where we had small towns that were still, they still had a pulse, they still had business, and there was an entire society that occupied these wonderful downtowns. And in America, we were swept by national retail corporations, with Walmart being at the helm, and people opened the floodgates for Walmart to come in, and it destroyed every town in America.
Yeah.
And destroyed the retail. And when you have a Walmart come in, you have to widen the highways to get to the Walmart. And then they close the store. And then you have a dead downtown and a dead Walmart. And so I watched all this happen tragically. The same thing happened to Atlanta. We had a beautiful downtown when I moved there in 1979 to go to architecture school. And there were department stores that looked like Italian palazzos inside. And it was completely rich and opulent. Even though I was a poor boy from a farming community, it was magnificent going into the city. Along came the highways, the expressways, the Walmarts, and it destroyed the city for a number of years. Thankfully, some of that damage is being reversed now. I used to be extremely satisfied designing big fancy houses in clubs. And that lasted about 3 years before I was completely disillusioned with that and realized it was no replacement for wonderful towns and cities.
Yeah.
And so along came this guy named Andres Dewani, who was a demigod to me. And I followed his work and only hoped that one day I could meet Andres. And so I stalked him in his towns, and eventually I met him. And he said, "Would you like to be the town architect of a small place that I'm doing near Atlanta in Covington?" And I said, "Yes."
Yeah.
And so I took that job and I worked it. And then I was offered the same thing for the town of Vickery. I took it. I did the same thing at Woodstock, and I just kept going. And who says you can't manage more than one town at a time? You can manage lots of them. You just have to have the right support and organization, and especially drive to do it. And so eventually I started doing work with Andres and his team internationally, and ended up doing 40 projects all over the world with them, in all over Europe, a lot in Asia, South America, Canada, the United States, Saudi Arabia, just all over, Brazil.
Yeah.
And I became adept at grasping different cultures pretty quickly and being able to innovate new housing designs in these cultures so that the produced designs both respected the culture, echoed a lot of the local vernacular / style of the area, but at the same time innovated the housing, because we don't live the same way we did as in the 1950s. It's very, very different. Yeah. And it was exactly what some of these places were seeking, was new housing design. And so I was able to travel, see the world, and pay for it by doing that. And at the same time, dabbling in urban planning. And I dabbled and dabbled and dabbled for years. And then when my focus came back to Atlanta, I started doing my own master plans And I did a lot of small ones. And then my big break came about 8 years ago with being able to design the town of Trillith. And Will McCollum and Cindy Cox were on my team. They're very good. And we had the development team at Trillith had, which used to be called Pinewood Forest after the London studio. The development team had been through 2 years of planning and they were very dissatisfied and they needed to make a decision. And a friend, Bill Lynch, who was leading the development team, said, "Hey, I'd like for you to take a look at this master plan. That's the good news. The bad news is you have 3 days to hatch the new master plan." Our competitor had had 3 months and they were a major firm. And so we were literally invited into the same room as them. And we pulled out our plan. We presented it. Our competitor said, "That's rubbish." And they rolled out a 10-foot roll of a gorgeous rendering showing this radiant city, which was geometrically very attractive and razzle-dazzle. But it paid no respect to the landscape, nor the culture, nor the wishes of Mr. Cathy to preserve the landscape because he's a gardener. And so we won. We won the competition. And so it fell in our lap rather immediately. And so we created a system of design called Elements to where we templated all the building types, different kinds of houses, row houses, and we built a system to deliver that town very quickly. And we invited in some guest architects to do some iconic buildings. And we had Lou Niquette, who's a great architect out of Birmingham, do the architecture in the town center. And for us, it was a major project being 1,400 houses. It became the largest geothermal powered town in America with hundreds of units on green power. And it's intensely pedestrian, with every other street being a pedestrian street. And in Atlanta, this was something incredibly different. And we were rewarded because we had rapid sales. We had market premiums of 3 times the norm out in the middle of nowhere. And our site became now it's the hub of the movie industry in America. So there are 35 studios. So it's larger than anything in Los Angeles. And so that was a big breakthrough for us. And you can get these projects and you get them and you go, that's stupid. Mm-hmm. You don't know what you're doing. And this has not been done. And how on earth are you going to do this? And really, you just have to take one day at a time and let it unfold, because there's so very few people concerned about the built environment. I mean, we're all members of these big organizations, NTBA and CNU and ULI. But those good projects are just a very small fraction of the total. There's probably 1 or 2%, and we really need to be flooding the market with exceptional planning, and the movement needs to grow. So if you have a will and you have a desire to change, the mechanics of how you do it are just little stumbling blocks. You will get there with the right drive, I think.
Yeah, like you said, you're really adept at creating really well adapted local vernacular neighborhoods and architecture. Yeah, how do you keep the costs down?
That's really a hard question. I think the important things are the building scale, meaning how large the building facade is relative to the street and what kind of spaces you're creating. So scale is very important. You know, proportion is another issue. If you have a simple facade, you can do an elegant, tall opening as a simple punched opening, or you can do something kind of ugly, like a terrible horizontal window that doesn't make any sense. And so the scale and the proportion are free. They're no cost visual assets. The materiality can become expensive. It's very important, but it's probably not as important as scale and proportion. In a place like Amsterdam, it's hard to imagine a facade not done in that really exquisite brick with these incredibly fine windows and front doors. But when you think about that, that's mostly one facade. And we're so used to doing three-dimensional buildings here in the United States, and even in new towns in Europe and the UK, we're obsessed with three-dimensional architecture. And if we would just drop that notion and think of a building only as the facade is really important. If you look at the end grain of a building in Amsterdam, it's pretty awful.
Yeah.
But the facade can be exquisite. And it's really, that's really the most important thing. And so we put a lot of money into the details of the building, which is important. And just acknowledging history in some respect at kind of a, I'm going to call it a cultural overlay, which the modernists mostly drop. Most of them drop, except for the early modernists did not, but the later ones did because they didn't understand the language anymore. But if you have a traditional facade and you execute it in the most clean brickwork with orderly fenestrations or windows, you can do very simple front doors done out of planks, and you can do one exquisite keystone or light fixture over the door and leave a lot of the rest to the imagination. And you've got you've got historical reference and total elegance. And I know the word elegance, totally subjective. It's like, what is that? to a modernist is something very different. But I think if you know the rules and you know how to strip off everything that's superfluous, you can get down to the essence of something. I did a house at Rosemary Beach, and it was a show house for Melanie Turner and Stan Benecke and a guy, Dutch guy named Vern van der Kleed. And I wanted a classical fountain on this white stucco wall that was feeding the swimming pool. And Vern said, you know, we can just cut the spout off flush with the white stucco and the water can just come out of the wall and you're not having to say everything, but people get it. You're implying that this is a classical fountain without being overt about it. Those are the kind of things that I think are important if you really want to create something on a budget, is know when to pull back and edit, but be very clever about the way you're editing. And I think you can get there. We're working on a prototype now that is different than anything we've ever done. And it will be a model for a prototypical city that can be extremely efficient to produce, that we want to roll out nationally and even internationally. And we will have, I just had Paul Moraine here working with Will to begin the process of templating the urban patterns so that it becomes a way to communicate with developers of, look what you can do on a much smaller piece of land. These are easy principles. This is easy architecture to do. It's going to be highly marketable because it'll be lower cost, and it will give the masses, the communities and little cities that they so desperately deserve, that the suburban builders and developers can't possibly deliver.
Yeah. I really get excited about those ideas, because often you have designers who want to reinvent the wheel, basically, and they mistakenly think that everything needs to be exciting and new to just be good. And now we have such a huge lack of housing, lack of affordable housing, lack of attractive housing, that we need these kind of simple but repeatable ideas.
Yeah.
Which, of course, it's maybe not easy to create something, but because you need to be incredibly smart to create something that is simple.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is what we need. And I also really like the term you used, cultural overlay, and about the three-dimensionality. That's absolutely something I recognize, and which I don't understand nowadays. Yeah.
I mean, we
can. Yeah.
Yeah. We have a face, and mostly I'm addressing your face. I'm not addressing the back of your head or your ears. And so it's really, humans are facades themselves, and there's nuance to the expression in the face, which can't possibly be on the back of your head. And there's movement, and there's mystery. You know, there's mystery. Mm-hmm. We all do have psychological facades, whether we admit it or not, it's another thing, but we all wear some forms of masks, and those masks are not that we're being deceitful. They're there for different reasons. They're there for protection, and we evolved with them. So they're cultural masks, and we know how to see through them, and they make conversations with other people very interesting. And we've kind of lost that idea in architecture, that fun and that social aspect to things, which cultural overlays and style give us. And they were expressions of their time, of something deeply human and emotional. They had nothing to do with practicality, of course, and everything to do with expression of what's in your inner self and the richness. So we've lost all that, and the modernists totally rejected all of that in favor of something that I think 100 years ago wasn't unique, and now it's not unique at all. It's actually very boring. It's expensive and boring. There's nothing exciting about the deconstructivist disaster in Utrecht.
Yeah. Yeah. Or what do you think about expressing the inner structure? Like, is that even interesting? Like, who needs to see the inner structure?
Who needs to see it unless you've never seen a building under construction? I mean, the Eiffel Tower is probably the most beautiful example of expressing the inner structure, but it's also an iconic building that's a piece of sculpture. Yeah. And you should not try to make a town out of skeletons, because there's a reason we have bones, flesh, skin, and facial hair. And why would we want to express our inner structure? Like, why would that be important at all? It actually strips off a lot of nuance.
And the funniest thing is that this really, well, kind of that hardcore modernist idea of a building only showing its function, with the modern forms of modernist buildings, like the most current modernist buildings, they often also have like really fanciful facades, but they're just like modernist plastic, white or very, screamy colors.
Yeah.
So they also have a facade, but then facades that do nothing to create this intrigue or expressing some deeper cultural meaning. It's just look at me.
Yeah, it's a look at me, and they're not, number one, they're extremely expensive to do. There's nothing cheap about a glass concrete and steel building. It has a very high carbon footprint, heavy carbon footprint, most inefficient thing ever construed. And it creates spaces that are uninhabitable because you're not going to cozy up and have a nice meal sitting by a piece of plate glass and steel because it's physically cold, and you can't even inhabit it. It's not like we're animals, contrary to what I think a lot of people believe, that we're somehow not animals, but we do have eyes and hair and ears and things. So I sort of think we're animals. And can you imagine a mouse wanting to cozy up in a glass box? I can't even imagine it. It's completely anti-human and neither environmentally very ignorant, and it's a destroyer of urbanism. It's anti-city.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. So a little bit more about your time at DPZ and the charrettes you did. Mostly, what is the beauty and the importance of doing charrettes?
Oh, that's a complicated question. And how was that, because of course, after doing so many charrettes, you wonder if charrettes are a good thing or not. I think charrettes are a very good method of designing a town collectively with a group of people that can share the same values. So for me, they work when you have town planners / urbanists, traffic engineers, architects, even a marketing sales and marketing. They're a very good method of getting professionals on the same page and doing it efficiently, lower cost, less time involved, and you can really accelerate a project using a charrette format and have co-authorship, which I find very meaningful. I love planning architecture and urbanism with a group of people. Much more rewarding than doing it in a void, and you get the best thoughts. I think presenting the charrette design to the community is also very effective, especially if you can have an opening and a pin-up and a closing. Those are very good ways of delivering great design quickly. I think in the contemporary mind, the charrette involves pulling in every layman who has absolutely no experience and giving them crayons and say, design your city, because you would not want someone doing collective brain surgery on your brain with switchblades with no experience. So I think it's naive to think that laymen can plan a city. Laymen are there to express their desires and needs, and then it should be turned over to more of the professional realm. And I don't say that arrogantly. I just say it as a matter of practicality that they would not have full understanding of what they're doing, and they're not studied in urbanism. They most of the time would not know what that is. So I think I've seen cities literally bring in townspeople and say, you're going to design your city. And these town planners are here to just essentially be your secretaries. And that's pretty disastrous. It's very disastrous. So a charrette can be very useful if it's used properly.
Yeah. It's already many steps better than just the blueprint planning we had, in the 60s, where they just imposed a plan on a people, let's say.
Yeah.
As long as there is a genuine interest in the opinions of the people and also their aesthetic preferences.
Yeah.
From the planner.
Yes.
That's what you need.
Yes. Yes. And sometimes those aesthetic preferences are of the more traditional palette to an area and not mm-hmm. the international modernist aesthetics that are in every country. And what's plopped up at the edge of Utrecht could be in Saudi Arabia, it could be in Atlanta. It simply doesn't matter. So most of the time I've seen lay people in visual preference surveys, they'll actually pick the images which embody good vernacular architecture, exquisite proportion and detail, given the choice. They usually choose that.
Yeah, yeah. The buildings they built around the central station in Utrecht, they don't say anything about the city. And people say, yeah, but you can recognize it because this building is only in Utrecht. Well, it could have been built everywhere. And the canal houses in Utrecht, you wouldn't even find them in other places. So yeah, there's an enormous difference there. So perhaps a little bit about new urbanism, because we have this established movement in urban planning. What do you think about this movement and perhaps about the label new urbanism and perhaps about the state of new urbanism? Where does it go? What things does it lack, or is it the solution? What's your view on it?
Well, I think new urbanism, I mean, it's really old urbanism that we're still rediscovering. And there's no such thing as new urbanism. It's just, it's a renewed interest mm-hmm. in urbanism. And the planning methods, or lack thereof, are well-established in traditional cities. And many, many of the plans of traditional cities, especially organic cities that evolved and were not planned academically, the settlement patterns, the circulation patterns are instinctive. And the best streets are the ones that are not uniform in width. They contract, they expand, and they form natural intersections that respond to transportation routes and topography. And so, you know, probably the people that preceded us on a piece of land were goats running up and down mountainsides mm-hmm. and whatnot, and forming natural congregation points. And humans came in and they started building things within these organic systems. And then we started getting clever and designing beautiful facades that frame these. And when you think about the idea of a terminating vista on, let's say, a church tower, those church towers were there because they could be seen by the most people. And so, of course, that's where the church wants to go, is that tower can be seen from many angles, and it deflects and leads you to another place. And so I think the best urbanism is instinctive, and it's organic in its best state. And of course, retailing it and old retail facades respond to this movement of traffic and visibility. Yeah. And you're going to get beautifully faceted facades depending on the location, because simply more people could see your goods. And so the urbanism is beautiful and elegant, but it evolved out of physiological conditions. So I think it's really important that urbanists understand this. I think that, quote, the new urbanist, if your plan is too loose, all you are is a densified suburb. And I find a lot of new urbanist projects, there's some really good ones, and then there's some that apply the new urbanist canons in a very mechanical kind of way, and it mm-hmm. produces streets that really don't capture energy, that are yeah. suffocated by setbacks and too many plants, and it fails to capture civic spaces in a three-dimensional manner. Places like Savannah and Charleston are not yeah. that. They are gorgeous, and they are urbanistic in the highest regards, because the buildings are on the street. They frame the spaces, and the gardens are either to the rear or to the sides, much as they are in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important that new urbanists start to get outside of their model that has been constructed, and push the boundaries. Don't be ashamed of producing fabric architecture, because mm-hmm. you know, if you look at this up close, everything's going to look the same. It's just fabric, and it's just my funky looking thing here that's the only thing that stands out. So I think we have to embrace the fabric of a place, and let there be just a few yeah. jewels, but don't let every building be a jewel. Back in the day, when Seaside was done, and even Rosemary and Alice, I'll go out on a limb and just say most of these places became hives of, we call them starchitects.
Yeah.
And if I wanted to be somebody, I would have a work at Seaside or Alice Beach. And I worked so hard to differentiate my house from everybody else's, because I wanted it to stand out and accelerate my career.
Yeah.
I don't know of anyone who says, I'm going to do all the fabric buildings. I'm going to do the boring stuff that actually makes up 95% of the city. Yeah. And I think it yeah. would be really wonderful for a new group of architects to start thinking of themselves as fabric architects. And who cares who gets the diamond? It doesn't really matter. There are going to be 50 people clamoring to do the diamond. And let the one who's the most powerful get it, or the most talented. But hopefully it's the most talented that gets the jewelry. But,
yeah.
but really focused on, we need to be focusing on making the place and less about the iconic buildings.
This is a very important point. This incentive, yeah, structure, you could almost say, in current urban design, perhaps it's also the way in how architects get their jobs nowadays, but also in how places are designed, that there is an incentive for people to want to create that very special building so then they can advance their careers.
Yeah.
I feel perhaps in the past it was, you had builders, you had architects who just wanted to win a project for a home because they set out a grid. People bought a plot, they attracted an architect, and then they filled that plot in with their own little building. But nowadays, because it is perhaps harder to build, every building becomes more valuable in a way to architects, to builders, because, well, there might be not so much work. I'm not sure. What do you think about this? So why does everybody want to be the star architect? How does that work? Incentive work?
Well, I think they want to be the star architects so they can, a lot of people are driven by ego. And I've had episodes of that in my past for certain. And I like to think of myself as more advanced than that now, though I still do have an ego. But I'm less mm-hmm. driven by ego now than I've ever been. I think that there's that, and there's the idea that if I become this starchitect and I'm published a lot, my fees are going to go from 5% to 25% of the construction yeah. costs. So I'm going to do everything I can to make yeah. myself mysterious and wear red plastic glasses and wear a black cape. and speak mysteriously and hang out with the right people, hang out with the Gucci's or whoever. But there are tremendous rewards in this society for being those Stark attacks. And I think a lot of people cave to that pressure, and certainly new urbanist projects have been a magnet for that. But I think it's easy to fall prey to that kind of lust for novelty instead of functioning as a design continuum in unison with a choir. And I find it all very distracting. And if you have too much going on in the architecture, especially form-wise, you're going to rob energy from the street. It will utterly suck the energy out of the street. Instead of containing the space, it will further disperse it. So I just think it's not that I can't do a fabulous front door on a house, but doing a front door that's fine with a pattern and system of windows that respects the order of the city is a very good move without turning somersaults down the street with too much form.
Yeah. So how are we going to make more people want to be that humble fabric architect when we live in a system where people are rewarded for doing the opposite?
Maybe we have to figure out how to monetize them. And it's called reuse fees. In our world, we would charge you reuse fees to use the same prototype over and over. And number two, we probably need some CNU awards that reward the people that create the fabric and not the diamonds.
Yeah. Just create some sort of a humongously big architecture prize for best fabric designer.
Yeah. So that really could be something. And it's so much more important than the diamonds.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, you can take a modernist architect. If you've got great fabric, they can drop a modernist diamond in and it somehow works. But that's really almost the only way that modernism works.
Yeah.
Is it would draw its energy from the setting. And that's the best modernist in Europe and in the UK. Their work is actually like that of it's a vampire. Because if I dropped it out on the outskirts of Atlanta on an expressway in a degraded environment, no one would look at it. But if you drop it into the middle of a historic center, it somehow is magnificent because it derives almost 100% of its energy from the historic fabric.
Wow, yeah.
I mean, I could do a glass really, box really in point. Venice and get published on it, right? Just take a piazza and violate it with a glass box with mirrors and you've got it. You'll be celebrated the world over.
It's the same thing in Amsterdam where they're building this white cube on the Leids Plain where we created a design competition, like a counter proposal. And that also, that project actually shows that although it is easy to get, well, famous for it, it also bears a risk because at the same time you get credit from your peers, you get loathing from the common folk.
Right, and, of course. Common folk being smarter in this case. We have this fixation with these mirrored glass boxes here, and every enlightened developer walks a piece of land and they walk through the forest and they go, can you imagine one of these glass boxes over here and how brilliant I am for thinking of that? And you're like, next, because you've said exactly the same thing as someone said last week. And there's zero originality to that. And even if it were original, it's not a very good idea.
Yeah, absolutely, man. But yeah, these are very interesting topics, and
musings.
And yes, they're so applicable to so many places. And what you said about the vampire, they draw on the existing urban fabric. It's so true. Yeah. It's almost painful.
Yeah, they pull the energy right out of it and derive their meaning solely as a counterpoint to the excellence that's there. And without the excellence and the excellent spaces that are there, they're utterly meaningless.
Yeah. What would you say about the exciting contrast they are supposed to create?
They do in fact create an exciting contrast because they provide a transparent object in a space that's mostly defined by solid forms. And so, yes, there is a delight in that contrast, but it's an old trick. It's an old trick, and any of us can do it. We can put a polished metal bean out in the middle of a square, or a glass cube, or a rainbow prismatic construct of some sort. And yes, it is effective. It does wow people. It's theater. I'm not being critical of it as far as a counterpoint, but we just need to face the fact that the object would not be very much without the setting, and the setting and the fabric is far more important than the than the prism that's created.
Yeah. And then nowadays you see cities where they try, like Rotterdam, where they try to exclusively build diamonds, let's say, and they kind of lose, it becomes kind of a, weird rarity cabinets.
The people don't even imagine these diamonds, what they're going to look like in 30 years. They're going to be rubbish because the glass will be smashed and can't be replaced, and the municipality doesn't care to replace it and doesn't have the funds to replace it. They're never clean. They never clean these things, and they become rubbish that have to be extracted eventually.
Yeah.
We've seen that over and over.
Yeah. And the point is, it's hard to imagine at this point, because people say, yeah, but they'll probably wash it, you know, they'll keep washing it. But in 30 years, looking at the 30-year-old towers in Rotterdam, for example, a lot of them look
terrible.
Not so good.
Terrible. Yeah. Yeah, the glass actually discolors. And the thing about modernism is it must be kept in a pristine condition. It cannot patina, because the patina destroys the illusion of the prism, of the crystalline structure. There's nothing uglier than a crystal that's dirty. And which, you know, you can't say that about the Colosseum. The Colosseum just looks better the more cruddy it is. And a lot of facades gracefully take on patina. But a modernist building, I mean, if you saw the Villa Savoy by Le Corbusier with grime on it, it would be revolting. Yeah. And so they cannot age.
Absolutely. And that's indeed the minimalism is A, expensive to do it in a, like, to do it well. And then it gets really dirty easily. So you need to keep it in pristine state. So otherwise it doesn't work.
That's correct. That's correct.
Try to do it in England.
You pick up a copy of Dwell magazine, and if you can imagine one of these interiors that's presented, but it needs to go through one day of somebody not doing their dishes or leaving their clothes on the floor, and the entire illusion of minimalist elegance is destroyed. And don't have a child, don't have a cat or a dog, because they cannot withstand normal human occupation.
Yeah. Maximalism for the win. in this case. Yes. Perhaps a last or a semi-final question about, well, Atlanta and also the sprawl in the United States in general. So the urban sprawl, the enormous size of the car suburbs. What are your thoughts on, yeah, what happened there, and how can we prevent or perhaps even fix sprawl?
Whew. That is hard to imagine, fixing some of this sprawl. I think what happened is city planning devolved from actually designing a city in an urbanistic manner, and it became coursework on codes and entitlements and the normal bureaucracy of controlling what's done on land. And so there is no design was completely abstracted, and city planning was reduced to code compliance. And at the same time, transportation departments were given untold billions to move cars around ahead of any other system, move them around and put in freeways where they thought would relieve congestion or provide economic development for a certain section of the country. And so between the two systems and creating a framework that rewards playing by the bureaucratic rules versus good design, it led to sprawl. And we have urban sprawl, we have suburban sprawl. And my friend Galina Takieva, she says you also have rural sprawl, where you can strip zone a highway and you can drop in all kinds of rubbish along the way and strip it of its farmland and forest at the same time. And so it is really hard for me to imagine going up against these systems that are so firmly placed. Yeah. And I don't have the solution to that. And I think it's going to take a massive effort and a massive campaign to educate the public on, here's what you had before, here's what happened, which no one likes, incidentally. Mm-hmm. But how do you arrest that, and how do you educate the public on what is best for your society? And I have a feeling part of that campaign would be for Americans would be let's restore classic America, or let's restore our town and countryside so that our children have healthy, socially interactive places to grow up in that are not overlooking freeways and strip malls. And so I think it just needs to be a very inclusive public awareness campaign, and what you can do to change it, and a set of documents that you can request that your officials look at and adopt. And it needs to be laid out very plainly in non-elitist language. As new urbanists, we like to use fancy words. Mm-hmm. We like to talk over people's heads. And we need to speak plain English for most people to be able to grasp this. And so I don't think it's too late, but I also don't think we're doing a whole lot to be able to create the kind of change that's needed. A lot of it can be positioned as economics. If I can show county commissioners that if you maintain the rural countryside and you fortify your towns, number one, you're going to save a lot of money in infrastructure expenses. And for Americans, we're going to keep our taxes down. You know, that's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. Very important. So it's giving them the tools to be economically conservative and accountable to their constituents. And so I think a lot of it can be presented to them in a very dry way of simple economics. You're going to prosper by creating the right system, and you're actually going to raise taxes and increase
strong towns.
Yeah. So we have to do better at creating that communications kit, but both here and internationally, because, you know, they're retrofitting India and they're putting in clover leaves on every traditional intersection in India.
Yeah.
Just ramrodding it through the cities. And I mean, they've been to suburban Atlanta clearly and gotten inspired. So
at any rate. Yeah. And perhaps lead by example. I mean, if you have some really popular places where people want to live, and you show like, hey, this is also possible, and maybe urban infill or like redevelopments, perhaps even in place like Detroit, where they built whole new communities that are more walkable, more attractive. If enough people know about those or see those,
you
might get higher demand for those places. And I think as there is an incentive to build those places, then you will get it.
Yes. And in America, most Americans are, no one's going to tell me what to do with my land. It's this land's right kind of stuff that goes on here. Because we threw off the old chains of the aristocrats in Europe, and now we're free Americans, and we have pitchforks and tractors, and we can put up anything we want on our property. So I think we need to figure out how to do that, address that, and it could be something as easy as we want to expand your rights of what you can do. And here is how you do it. You design the ideal American town, and you have city, town and rural, and we're going to let you in your barn. You can do banquets for weddings. You can do this. You can do, we can position this as an expansion of land's rights within the rule book. And it could be appealing.
Interesting. So to close off, what are your hopes for the future of urban America and architecture around the world? What inspires you? What do you hope that changes? What do you see changing?
I am hoping to bring, especially through some of the systems we're designing now, I'm hoping to bring about great awareness of good places and good urbanism. And I'm going to say fair architecture. Doesn't have to be great. I want it to be certainly not bad. I want it to be fairly good. I want people to be able to make a home in places like this. New urbanism should not be for just the elite. New urbanism should be for all classes of people. And so my goal, the last quarter of my career now, is to make good places for all spectrums of society.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. I think that's a beautiful place to thank you for this wonderful interview. A lot of really great, well, let's call them truth bombs have been dropped. And I like it that way.
Life would not be very much fun without the truth bombs. It's been a pleasure for me as well. Thank you, Ruben.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Aesthetic City podcast. I've included a link to Lou Oliver's studio website in the podcast description to learn more. If you like our content and want to support what we do, you can support us in various ways. The easiest way is to give this podcast a favorable review. Another way to support this podcast is to share it with colleagues and friends. You can also follow us on X, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or our Substack newsletter. And finally, the ultimate way to support The Aesthetic City is to become a patron. Find the Patreon link in the description. For more information about this platform, visit theaestheticcity.com. Thank you, until next time.